This is Audible.
Random House Audio Publishing presents The No Spin Zone, Confrontations with the Powerful and Famous in America. This is the author, Bill O'Reilly. The No Spin Zone. This is it. We're on live in the No Spin Zone. It's a nightmare place for charlatans and deceivers, but it's a great place for you and everybody else who believes in truth, common sense, and decency. In the No Spin Zone, you can watch those charlatans stammer and the spinners slip out in shame. See, this is a place I've set up over my years of TV interviewing with a special set of purposes. In the No Spin Zone, rationalizations are scorned, lies are rejected, and equivocations are mocked. It's a place where quite a few smirks have turned to frowns. To anybody who uses power and fame to exploit the less powerful, the zone is a very dangerous place. On the other side, the zone is comforting to those who live life with a sense of fairness, for it is a place where truth is sought without regret. When Ernest Hemingway decided to write stories that spotlighted the harsh truth alive in this world, he said anybody trying to do that better have a built-in bull detector. I believe I inherited this device from my late father, who would walk out of the room if you couldn't make your point in 60 seconds. Is the No Spin Zone needed? Well, here's how bad things have gotten in America. The Josephson Institute of Ethics reports that nearly half of all high school students steal. 7 in 10 admit to cheating on tests, and 92% say they lie. And most of those kids don't feel much guilt at all. Remorse is becoming obsolete in the USA. Excuses cover all misdeeds. After all, there is a disease to cover just about every immoral action. And if you question that, you are a mean, insensitive person. The misery industry has it all covered. What caused this deplorable state of affairs? Number one, cowardly parenting. Number two, corrupt national leadership. As the tree is bent, so it will grow. And today, kids can look all around at so many bent adults, they can hardly guess what it means to be straight. People basking in the spotlight, and I don't mean just politicians, are forever presenting terrible examples to the children of America. Public misbehavior by the famous is a powerful teaching tool. For example, any wide-awake youngster knows that you can make a handsome living in America by being able to spin the truth, that is, twisting the facts of a troubling situation until it is impossible to figure out what the hell is going on. In the CIA, it is called disinformation. In the world of politics, show business, finance, and the law, it's simply called spin. Certain immoral acts can be chalked up to gaining experience. Ever heard of any famous person's youthful indiscretions? Experiments with illegal drugs? Someone caught driving under the influence is, in my no-spin zone, a criminal. But with a highly paid lawyer spin, there's no crime. There is only a chemical dependence. Even the slowest of children pick up these lessons very quickly. And by the way, it is hard to argue with Washington, D.C.-based psychiatrist Dr. Sally Satel, who argues that labeling addiction a chronic, relapsing brain disease gives everybody a pass. Criminals don't commit crimes, they make mistakes. And often, it is society's fault that these mistakes even happened in the first place. At the end of the day, every child has learned the lesson of spin. Almost every wrong action can be stripped of consequences, along with the need for feelings of guilt and remorse. It all ends nicely. The wrongdoer walks and maybe even prospers from his problems. Robert Downey Jr. landed a plum role on Ally McBeal. The lawyer earns his dough and sometimes the media benefit from increased reader and viewership. The show must go on. But this is wrong. Where there is no vision, the people perish, wrote King Solomon in Proverbs more than 2 millennia ago. When there is no public morality, the nation loses its way. Who quoted Solomon's words in his acceptance of the nomination of his party as presidential candidate in 1992? Hint, it wasn't George Herbert Walker Bush. No, the man echoing Solomon's warnings about public morality was William Jefferson Clinton. How ironic it is that Mr. Clinton and his cohorts, during impeachment, gave America the most effective lessons in the history of this country of what spin can really do. Armies of well-paid men and women marched into the living rooms of America via television, weaving blankets of deceit for Bill Clinton. "It's just about sex," they wailed. "Everybody lies about sex. It's a right-wing conspiracy. It doesn't rise to the level of impeachment," and on and on. The president himself set a terrific example by lying outright to the nation on national television. None of this, of course, was lost on the kids, who, according to a variety of surveys, are lying like crazy and now have embraced oral sex with, you might say, presidential abandon. Mr. Clinton's excellent spin adventure turned out to be just the beginning of the empire of spin. The presidential election of 2000 turned out to be a swamp of distortion, diversion, and brazen deception. Both sides presented unprincipled mouthpieces to utter exhausting, incomprehensible bilge. And much of the press in America readily accepted all the garbage without analysis or reflection. After all, it's too difficult and dangerous to challenge those in authority. The cocktail party invitations may stop coming. We live, finally, in a just world, so maybe that's why the results were so close and why about half of those eligible to vote didn't even show up. I'm not spinning for them. They let their country down. But the exit polls show less than 20% of Americans were enthusiastic about their vote. Most of us voted for the lesser of two spinners. The kinds of things I've mentioned are not trivial to me. They have driven me to disgust and near despair in recent years. That is exactly why I created the No Spin Zone on my TV program, The O'Reilly Factor. The zone is open to anyone. I mean that. We invite all newsmakers to come in and chat with us. If you don't see certain people there who are hot in the news, that's probably because they refuse to enter the zone of no spin. Al Gore would not get his passport stamped. Ditto the new junior senator from New York. And former presidential hopeful Elizabeth Dole and Bob Jones III, president of the notorious Bob Jones University down in South Carolina, all declined to enter the zone. Perhaps the most famous no-spin, no-show of all is Jesse Jackson. We investigated his finances for a year before cracking the case wide open. Jackson spun the tax-exempt payments to Mistress Karen Stanford as omissions on the tax returns of one of his foundations. Sure, Jesse. Celebrities from other worlds, especially actors and actresses, shy away from the zone as well. As you probably know, practically any magazine interview you read has been carefully controlled by the star's publicist. Editors and writers agree to avoid touchy issues, otherwise they could lose access to other celebrities handled by the same publicist. When you see a famous person walk into the no-spin zone, no such bargain has been struck. There are never preconditions for an interview. Some who don't like the zone spin it as a place where rude questions are asked. That's nonsense. All I ask is for powerful people to respond honestly to the questions, and if they can't, explain why. The Fifth Amendment is alive in the zone, but if you take it, be prepared to explain why you are taking it. The children of America have seen with their own eyes that liars can win and cheaters can prosper. They know our nation will accept venal behavior and, in some cases, reward it with tremendous wealth and power. So why shouldn't they lie, cheat, and steal? After all, it's now part of the culture. After all, the president was caught lying, and he walked. The antidote to this is some no-spin news about people who reject bad behavior. Derek Jeter, the spectacular New York Yankees shortstop, recently signed a huge 10-year contract. Jeter seems to be an honest, hard-working guy and thus a good role model for kids. When asked if that would change now that he makes mega millions and if the money would go to his head, Jeter opined, "No chance, my dad would kill me. A no-spin parent. We need millions more of them." In the hopes of kicking the living daylights out of the spin that has become part of our national dialogue, I brought together 16 turbocharged interviews about the most intense issues of the day. We'll discuss problems like teen sex, inappropriate gay activism, and the exploitation of working Americans. Also, raunchy entertainment. I've chosen the topics that I believe are extremely relevant to all our daily lives. In each section, you hear two sides, mine and the opinion of someone who's deeply involved with the issue we're talking about. These debates are taken from interviews I've conducted during my 27 years in broadcast journalism. The interviews are only edited to leave out the uhs, does, uh-ohs, and are you kidding me's, many of which are mine. Printing all the equivocation verbatim would drive you nuts, so I just get to the pith of the interview. as is my wont. In each of these sections, you are the final judge of who has the strongest argument. Because it's my audiobook, I get to set things up with commentary, and that may be a bit unfair, but hey, it's my audiobook. So, this audiobook does not try to persuade you to believe a certain way. I am trying to set forth some insights, some solutions, and some perspective on the most vexing problems of the day. You'll let me know if I succeed. Each section stands alone. You may find yourself fast-forwarding or rewinding depending on what subject or personality catches your interest on a particular day. Also, I've chosen some interviews that are like verbal boxing matches. Who jabs with the stronger argument? Who gets knocked down verbally? You be the judge. Will George W. Bush's arguments with me on the death penalty stand up or get flattened? What about Al Sharpton's provocations on race? Or Susan Sarandon's charges of police racism in New York City? And, as I've been asking all these years, how does Jesse Jackson get all those millions of dollars? So settle in and don't be squeamish. You are keeping the score at all times. There's usually a loser in the no-spin zone, and sometimes it's me. But sympathy is not in play. We are chasing down the truth here, and that is a hard game. Chapter 1, Issue 1, Sexual Deviants Who Prey on Children. The opponent, Floyd Abrams, First Amendment attorney. If you are 35 or older, chances are good that your childhood in America was pretty much like mine, no matter where you grew up. By age 6, I was out of the house most of the time after school and all of the time during the summer, playing with my tight group of friends. There were limits. For example, if I was late for dinner at 6, there was hell to pay. Otherwise, I was on my own in the great outdoors. My parents seemingly had no fear that I would be harmed by sinister outside forces marauding around my Long Island neighborhood. Sure, I might hurt myself roughhousing, but hey, those were the breaks. My father didn't sound like football announcer John Madden, but he had Madden's mindset. Play rough, take your chances. With my dopey friends, whom you might have met in my last book, The O'Reilly Factor, I made the most of the deep woods 3 blocks from my house. We climbed 30 feet up into the thick leafy branches to build rickety tree houses. We tunneled underground like moles. We threw rocks at each other. We rolled around in the dirt completely unsupervised by annoying adults. It never occurred to us that some older guy in an overcoat might drive up and try to hurt us. Yes, my father once said something about never taking a ride with a stranger, but he didn't say why, and he didn't make an issue out of it. And he didn't seem concerned that his eldest son might be taken hostage at some point. How times have changed. And that's the terrifying subject of this section's debate with a distinguished First Amendment lawyer and public figure who I believe is absolutely wrong in putting the rights of special, read perverted, interests ahead of the safety of American children. Parents today are rightfully worried about their children being abducted or abused, even in their own neighborhoods. But why is that? Are there more child molesters in the United States now than in my childhood years in the 50s and 60s? Are they bolder for some reason? Is it possible they are being encouraged? Statistically, it is impossible to know. Officials at the FBI and the Department of Health and Human Services say they don't have accurate statistics for child abuse and abduction before 1990. According to the federal government, more than 100,000 American kids were sexually molested in 1998, or 1.5 children per 1,000. In 1999, nearly 32,000 kids were kidnapped, most by relatives. England does a better job of tracking the danger to kids trend. Scotland Yard says the number of convictions for gross indecency with a child doubled between 1985 and 1995. So the data suggests that society has become more menacing to children and that more adults are willing to risk imprisonment and social destruction to molest children. The question is why? Some believe that widespread, often hysterical, TV coverage has possibly encouraged deviant behavior toward children. Because of television news, crimes against children have been magnified greatly. The heartbreak of any child damaged by an adult is spread from coast to coast immediately, and the experts start prattling on, some of them sympathetic to the disease or the condition of the victimizer. No one can say for sure, but the notoriety of the crimes may attract pedophiles who are risk takers. We are obviously not talking about rational people here. But there's also something else in play in this country that is much more subtle. The gradual contagion of non-judgmental acceptance. The result of this contagion is that behavior that would have been roundly condemned 40 years ago is now understood, or in some cases, even accepted. Two college student parents killed their newborn baby and left his body in a trash can outside a cheap motel. The pair received hundreds of calls of sympathy and support. After all, it was understandable that they panicked. In the end, a judge sentenced them to less than 3 years in prison each. In Wisconsin, an expectant mother tried to poison her fetus with alcohol one day before the due date. She received no jail time, as supporters petitioned the press and the court with tales about her life of woe. Throughout the country, drug-addicted babies are routinely returned to the mothers who have already damaged them physically and perhaps limited their learning potential for life. But remember, the mother has a disease. Can society deprive the mother of raising her own children? Well, I damn well would. But I seem to be in the minority these days, as my understanding threshold does not reflect the society in which we live. In all the examples I've cited, the child's life is devalued in favor of the adult's situation. How did this happen in America? Here's my answer, which is the lead-in to our first encounter in the no-spin zone. The welfare of a child means less today because of the promotion and acceptance of certain so-called special interests. The most notorious example, and I'm not making this up, is an organization based in the United States called the North American Man-Boy Love Association. It advocates the legalization of sex between men and boys as young as 8 years old. Let me repeat that. The North American Man-Boy Love Association advocates the legalization of sex between men and boys as young as 8 years old. This vile NAMBLA group was formed in 1978 and calls for the empowerment of youth in the sexual area. It says it does not engage in any activities that violate the law. Oh yeah? What about the fact that NAMBLA was involved in funding an orphanage in Thailand that allowed grown men to rape and molest the children who live there? And what about the case of child rape in Ohio, where NAMBLA was found guilty of complicity in the crime? The Ohio Court of Appeals ruled that NAMBLA's literature, found in the possession of the rapist, showed preparation and purpose in encouraging the rape. It gets much, much worse. A NAMBLA member recently raped and murdered a young boy in Massachusetts. In October 1997, 10-year-old Jeffrey Curley was playing near his home in Cambridge when two men tried to lure him into a car. When he resisted, Salvatore Sicari and Charles James got brutal. They wound up killing the boy and then drove to Maine, where they dumped his body in a river. Both men were eventually arrested, convicted, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Prosecutors at the trial produced as critical evidence a diary kept by James. In it, he flat out stated that he became obsessed with having sex with young boys after he joined NAMBLA. How did the organization allegedly poison him with its ideas? According to the diary, James received NAMBLA literature in the mail and visited the group's website on computers at the Boston Public Library. Clearly, these NAMBLA people wanted to get their message out. According to lawyers familiar with the website, it actually posted techniques designed to lure boys into having sex with men, and also supplied information on what an adult should do if caught. Jeffrey Curley's parents are suing NAMBLA in federal court for $200 million. And guess who is defending NAMBLA in the case? Can you spell ACLU? That's right, the most powerful free speech watchdog in the world is using its money and resources to make sure that NAMBLA is not driven out of business. Is this an outrage or what? The amazing truth is that the American Civil Liberties Union is spending membership dues defending the lawsuit. In a statement, it said, regardless of whether people agree with or abhor NAMBLA's views, holding the organization responsible for crimes committed by others who read their materials would gravely endanger our important First Amendment rights. Baloney! I respect the ACLU's goal of protecting the rights of all Americans. At their best, this group is courageous in defending legitimate expressions of opinion, some of which, like the Nazi marches, are pretty vile. But NAMBLA is a different matter, because the freedom to harm children is not built in to our Constitution. Attorney Floyd Abrams walked onto the O'Reilly Factor set confident and clear-eyed. He had won many of these debates in the past. In my introduction to the segment, I told the audience that I believe NAMBLA was guilty of promoting statutory rape and was a seditious organization in the sense that it wanted to undercut the moral foundation of the United States. Abrams opened his remarks by saying that the ACLU serves the public by serving even an awful bunch of creeps. Then we got down to the heart of the matter and things got heated. "This doesn't have anything to do with free speech," I said straight off. "But of course it does," Counselor Abrams said. I told him, "No, this has to do with aiding and abetting promoting a crime on the website." "If that's what they do, then the family will win the case," Abrams said. "But until they show that, there should be somebody brave enough, and the ACLU is, to show up." "I think you're dead wrong," I said, "because what the ACLU is doing is allowing an organization to corrupt children. In doing so, the ACLU becomes part of the crime if it wins and allows NAMBLA to get away with it." "So they shouldn't have a lawyer, right?" Abrams countered. "They shouldn't have the ACLU," I said. "Throw them in jail," Abrams said. "I'd put them in jail in a heartbeat," I told him. "I know you would." "Each lawyer," I went on, "has a responsibility to choose the case that promotes justice. These people need the ACLU," my guest insisted. "Sure, they need it, because they are a criminal enterprise that exists for only one reason, to encourage statutory rape. The ACLU's representation is free, and NAMBLA is staying alive because of it. When the ACLU chooses which cases to take, it has a responsibility to the people who are paying dues to it. The thing is, no decent human being should be helping NAMBLA. And I know many ACLU members who are absolutely mortified that this organization has stained itself with this case. It should be obvious that I'm a big free speech supporter. The Factor would have been shut down a long time ago if the First Amendment wasn't sacred. But we need a clear-thinking ACLU to protect our freedom of expression, not some radical organization that is lost in a fog of self-righteousness. I asked ACLU President Nadine Strossen to address the NAMBLA issue, but she declined. That was interesting. Ms. Strossen has talked with me before and is anything but camera shy. And what about the authorities? Why isn't the Justice Department prosecuting NAMBLA? If the Ohio court nailed them, what's wrong with the feds? The answer to that one is that the feds don't care. We have become a nation held hostage to self-serving rationalizations of special interest groups. The zone is sickened by the cowardice of the Justice Department, as well as by the ACLU's irresponsibility. Using the First Amendment as a cover for the subversion of our laws violates public safety. Spinning the NAMBLA ACLU deal as a rights issue is a disgrace. During the interview, Abrams said to me, "One thing NAMBLA didn't say was go out and kill anybody. One thing it didn't say was go out and rape anybody." But as any good citizen knows, it's not what you don't say that counts. It's what you do say. If the ACLU cannot acknowledge that it's a crime to conspire to have sex with children, a hurtful and brutal act physically, emotionally, and morally, then the American Civil Liberties Union does not deserve our respect or our support. Chapter 2, Issue 2, Sex Ed in Your Child's Classroom. The opponent, Dr. Joycelyn Elders, former Surgeon General of the United States. It's not just the shameless perverts we need to worry about. Our children can also be assaulted by well-meaning public officials, teachers, and other adults in responsible positions. And these intrusions on the young are far more powerful than the lurid crimes that grab headlines, because they are often very personal and delivered to the child one-on-one by influential adults. Take the supposedly enlightened movement towards sex education. Right now, in many of the nation's public schools, there are sex education classes that get right to the heart of the matter. You get the what, you get the how. You get the birth control, you sometimes get nonverbal approval, and in rare cases, outright encouragement to engage in sexual activity. Driver's ed leads to drive in a car, right? Sex ed has to be handled with the proper touch, pardon the pun, or, well, you get the idea. I taught high school in Opa-locka, Florida, considered at the time to be one of the worst slums in South Florida. The kids at my school knew all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. They needed guidance, not instruction. They needed emotional maturity and perspective. They listened very, very closely to everything an adult said about sex, and especially the way it was said. Sex ed for me was the talk my father gave me when I turned 13. It was awkward for both of us, as the Irish aren't exactly known for their Dr. Ruth-like candor in these matters. The talk was also somewhat unnecessary. I already knew the basics from seminars with my friends using Playboy magazines as text, and my father's words were highly theoretical because the reality was I had about as much chance as landing the great white whale as I did of having sex. Teenage girls want to date smooth guys. I was a barbarian, but I gave my father points for trying. As a young teacher, I was more relaxed speaking about sex than my father ever was, but I was careful. Students have a way of misquoting any provocative comments, and that can lead to big trouble in a Catholic high school. Some of my students, as young as 15, were having sex, and almost everyone in the school knew about it. I encouraged the use of contraceptives for any American who did not want to become a parent. I spoke of this in a general sense, illuminating the lesson with specifics about poverty, divorce, and child deprivation. Most of the kids got the message. Some didn't. It is always that way. Predictably, the school administration didn't like my direct approach. They were determined to control the sexuality of the students by threatening them with various punishments for risque behavior. This, of course, was insane. The more you just say no, the more enticing certain kinds of behavior become. The issue came to a boil over football, of all things. In Florida, as in many parts of the country, Friday night high school football games are big. And because the weather in South Florida is hot until Thanksgiving, many of the high school girls were going to the games dressed like Anna Nicole Smith in full seduction mode. Hot pants and skimpy halter tops topped the dress hit parade. Many teachers were appalled. A faculty meeting was called to discuss the menacing problem. One of the teachers asked what proper attire for football games actually was. Anyone? Anyone? Your humble correspondent rose to the occasion. Okay, proper attire for a football game, I said earnestly, begins with shoulder pads, a helmet, knee and thigh pads, and spiked shoes, but never high heels. A few of the male teachers actually laughed out loud, but were silenced by the principal's stern glare. Most of the female teachers were aghast that I could be taking this desperate situation so lightly, but that's me, Bill Light. Anyway, the meeting was ridiculous and went on for hours. I headed for the men's room after about 30 minutes and never came back. The last thing I heard was somebody suggesting that navels be covered or something like that. The next day, I took my own kind of action. I told my co-ed classes that young women who dress provocatively are usually seeking attention and would not be taken seriously by boys. How you dress, I suggested, shows the world what you think of yourself. So if a girl dresses like a tart or a boy like a bum, well, word got around campus fast. After that, only the hardcore kids continued to show up at games looking like Baywatch extras. They looked woefully out of place next to the students who got the message and dressed appropriately. Teenagers can be persuaded to act responsibly if they are engaged in a relevant way. You don't have to set yourself up as the sex police, just talk sense. But right now in our nation's public schools, sense is on the run. From 1993 to 94, Dr. Joycelyn Elders was the Surgeon General of the United States, a position that can be used to address the most stubbornly persistent of health-related social problems. I greatly admire her personally. She rose from an impoverished Arkansas childhood in a segregated black community to become a very successful pediatrician and then one of the most influential women in the country. Early in her career, she served as a first lieutenant in the Army. Later, then-Governor Bill Clinton appointed her to head the Arkansas Department of Health. An avowed and outspoken liberal, Dr. Elders got herself in trouble as Surgeon General by saying that masturbation should be taught and promoted in the nation's public schools. In her view, such a practical alternative to intercourse would cut the rate of unwanted pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. After a crescendo of protests from the public and many officials, President Clinton fired her. Dr. Elders is extremely permissive in other areas as well. She advocates the legalization of hard drugs as a way to reduce the crime rate and promotes abortion as a form of birth control. I don't deal well with people who have a love affair with the fetus, she said memorably, but won't take care of the children. Her son was an intravenous drug user at one time, so she has a personal interest in America's narcotics problem. A charming woman with an easy, engaging smile, she entered the no-spin zone with enthusiasm. I happened to disagree with her, but I couldn't help liking her. I began by asking Dr. Elders, "You must have known you were going to get in trouble over the masturbation remarks." "Why?" she countered. "Come on, this is America," I said. 90% of men and 70% of women masturbate and the rest lie," she retorted. "Parents don't want it taught in school," I said. "Nobody has to teach anybody," she said. "God taught us how to do it. But we should stop lying to children, telling them hair will grow on their hands or they'll go blind or they'll go crazy." "Why can't parents take care of that?" I asked. "If all children had parents like you, who would educate their children, talk about the drug issue, talk about teen pregnancy, talk about sexuality, we wouldn't have the problems." "But, doctor, surely you understand that some parents don't want a teacher, an outsider, talking to their children about such personal issues, and surely they have a right to demand that not be done." "You're absolutely right," Dr. Elders said. "All they have to do is say they don't want their children in that class." "But you know how kids are," I persisted. "As soon as masturbation is brought up, they'll run out and tell their friends, so that really doesn't work." "Poor children whom nobody has ever taught anything, are we just to throw them away?" "I think not," she said. She's right on target that lack of information of all kinds hinders poor children in this country. But masturbation, in my opinion, was the wrong battlefield for making that point. Schools have no business teaching sexual technique of any kind, no matter what the well-meaning intention. I can't believe that one parent in 1,000 or 10,000 wants some teacher explaining how sex is accomplished. There are simply too many different attitudes about sex. If Dr. Elders were teaching the course at a local junior high, her acceptance of wholesale abortion would emerge. Another teacher might be equally permissive about homosexuality, or believe in total sexual abstinence before marriage, or think we'd all be better off physically and mentally if we practice all the Kama Sutra positions. Talk about phys ed. You get the picture. The individual's attitudes on this highly private, highly personal subject are always going to have an effect on the discussion. Not many of us want our kids learning history from a dedicated communist or evolution from someone who believes only in Adam and Eve. As a parent, I don't want a teacher's sexual outlook passed along to my child. But the repercussions of irresponsible sex, that's what must be taught. The links between irresponsible sex and poverty, divorce, violence, and disease should be drummed into every American kid from age 10 onward. I mean pedal to the metal here. And that's where Dr. Eldridge should concentrate her energies and persuasive skills. If she had, she would have accomplished so much more, not only for the poor children of this country, but for all the kids. Here's the headline in the endgame regarding sex ed. Kids need a healthy dose of reality. Have a baby out of wedlock and there's a good chance you'll be poor the rest of your life. Have unprotected sex and you could die. If you don't believe me, take a walk down any ghetto street, visit any local hospice. Sure, public schools can perform a valuable service by dispensing birth control when a counselor agrees. You're never going to convince everybody to wait. But parents have rights, too. And on the issue of sexual instruction, their rights have to be respected by Joycelyn Elders and everybody else. Government does not have the right to intrude into the fabric of the family. Learning sexual technique in high school is not going to get you into college and may get you on the welfare rolls. Give the kids and their parents a break, okay? Our schools should be G-rated institutions, at least in the classroom. Leave the sex where it belongs, on television. And while we're speaking of parenting, you might want to hear about Dr. Elder's own experience as a mother of a drug-abusing son. At one point, she opined that more people die from using tobacco than from using illegal drugs, and she's right about that. Still, in my view, the corrupting influence of substance abuse has to be condemned by society. Just because we have problems with alcohol and tobacco doesn't mean we should add to those problems by legalizing more intoxicants. I had to ask Dr. Elders if she was angry with the people who got her son involved with narcotics. "No," she said frankly, What I got angry about was how we as a society, and I as his mother, didn't know enough to intervene effectively. Dr. Elders took responsibility. She also took effective action. When we talked, her son had kicked his habit and was staying clean. Even though the doctor and I disagree on the solutions to these terrible problems, I know she's sincere in trying to help. The goal of the zone is not always to reach agreement, but to listen and consider. In other words, to think, and not to give in to, in Steve Allen's term, dumpf. You'll see what I mean by that in the next section. Chapter 3, Issue 3, Violence and Sleaze in Our Living Rooms. The opponent, Steve Allen, comedian and activist. If you were a kid in the late 50s, there's a good chance your thinking was shaped by two television programs, The Mickey Mouse Club and Howdy Doody. If you had asked me back then what I thought of these shows, I would have mocked them. Little wise guy that I was, I smirked at the sight of a bunch of kids wearing large rodent ears and grinning themselves into roadmaps of wrinkles. That, if you have to be told, was Mickey's gang, the Mouseketeers. As for the hokey puppet show, I was annoyed enough to talk back to the black and white TV. "Hey kids, what time is it?" some guy named Buffalo Bob yelled. A studio audience packed with kids screamed back, "Howdy doody time." This gave me such a headache I can't tell you, and my reply to Buffalo Bob's timeline was, "It's time for you to leave, buckskin man," or words to that effect. The whole thing enthralled my sister, though, but put me in a foul mood. I can still hear Sis singing, "M-I-C, see you real soon, K-E-Y, why? Because we like you." I was outraged. However, you will notice that more than 40 years after first hearing these lines, I still remember them. That's the power of the tube. My little sister and most of the calmer kids in my Long Island neighborhood loved Howdy Doody and the Mouseketeers. They talked about them. They repeated the lame jokes. They wore rodent ears themselves. I couldn't figure it out. I also couldn't figure out why Mouseketeer Annette Funicello's sweatshirt kept expanding outward. It had a big picture of Mickey Mouse on it, and at the end of the second season of programs, the mouse on Annette's shirt looked like he had the mumps, if you know what I mean. Anyway, if you could gather all the kids in the USA in one place today and you yelled, "Hey kids, what time is it?" the answer would probably be, "It's Stone Cold Steve Austin time," or "It's Melrose Place time," or perhaps "Buffy the Vampire Slayer time." Howdy and Buffalo Bob would be appalled. The late Steve Allen was appalled. In fact, he went so far as to blame the television industry for corrupting the nation's youth. Allen believed that programs dumbed kids down and encouraged antisocial behavior. He had the resume to form that opinion. He invented The Tonight Show in the 50s and was a pioneer in TV comedy, clean TV comedy. Allen and the actress Shirley Jones, the Partridge Family mom, co-chaired the Parents Television Council, which supported advertisements that asked the question, "Are you fed up with steamy, unmarried sex situations, filthy jokes, perversion, vulgarity, violence, killings, etc.?" Bill Cosby and Tim Allen, among other celebrities, joined the PTC's crusade. On a windy but warm day, the legendary entertainer sat down across from me on our outdoors Los Angeles set. Steve Allen's toupee was slightly askew, but his eyes still danced with mischief, and his familiar laugh was as hearty as ever. Here was a multi-talented human being who seemed to want to make every moment enjoyable for himself and everyone around him. He seemed a bit tired, but gave no evidence of the health problems that would kill him just a few months later. In the commercial break, before his segment began, Allen was cheerful, but when the camera lights went on and the subject turned to the current state of American television, there was no mirth in his voice. "Mr. Allen," I began, "you posed the question, are you fed up with steamy, unmarried sex situations, filthy jokes, perversion, vulgarity, violence, killings, etc.? Wow, you're not mincing any words here." "No," Allen said, "my word mints are broke. The main thing is all of that is legit. It's all documented. When I was a kid, I watched The Untouchables in combat," I said. "It didn't make me violent." "There's a difference between the problem of sexual vulgarity and violence," Allen said. "You are never going to be able to totally get rid of violence. First of all, it's part of the world, and you can't do a show about World War II or the Mafia and not have blood and guns and foul language, because that's part of reality, and I don't object to that. I don't want 6-year-old people to see it, but I don't object to it. But the problem with television, which comes into our homes, is that 7- and 8-year-old children are now seeing a hell of a lot of real vulgarity, and I haven't been able to hear anybody tell me that's good for the children or for the country. Do you think that watching these programs will make kids want to have sex? I asked him. No, Alan replied. Mother Nature makes them want to have sex. The argument is that when sexual material is dealt with on television and nobody has to worry about birth control or sexual disease, then the implication is, hey, it's all kind of cute and hip and let's do it, even though I've never met you before. I asked, so you believe kids are impressionable enough to pick up a message like, they're having fun at Beverly Hills High, I should have fun at my school? Yeah, I believe that, Alan said. There's a lot of documentation. This is not just some theory of mine. I am by no means a saint, but the sleaze and vulgarity on TV disgust even an old roué like me. It's part of the whole dumbing down, the coarsening. The question is, what kinds of parents are the kids today going to make? I think the answer is, not too good. Why? I asked him. Well, imagine an ideal father. Would you like it if he came home with a couple of broads on each arm? You see that image on TV. Are you referring to President Clinton? I asked, only half jokingly. That's another matter, Alan said. But really, if people don't know we have a problem here, then we're in worse shape than I thought. Steve Allen was right, of course. Society has become coarser because of lazy parents and an exploitative entertainment industry. The stuff that kids are exposed to on TV and in the movies and listening to on CDs has an enormous influence on them. If they don't have strong counter-influences, watch out. And it's not only fictional television in play. Some of the most influential people in our society, like Bill Clinton, Jesse Jackson, Robert Downey Jr., and Daryl Strawberry, just to name a few, provide dismal examples to the nation's youth. TV news lasers in on these guys and brings their lurid stories home to your home, where little Melissa and Scott are taking it all in. But Steve Allen was fighting a losing battle. This country hates censorship and loves money. Sleazy entertainment aimed at kids makes a lot of money, and the only way to stop it is for the government to censor it. That is not going to happen, and the entertainment industry is not going to police itself. Everybody in Hollywood has to make money in order to work, and few of these people are creative enough to do so without wallowing in the mud. Their jobs are more important than your kids, at least to them, and they are calling the shots in the wonderful world of entertainment. Parents, that's your cue again. The TV set is an inanimate object that requires electricity and perhaps cable fees in order to beam stuff into your house, meaning you control it, not the other way around. No parent has to wait for the V-chip or another kind of high-tech blockade. Just monitor what your kids see. And when something objectionable gets through your safety net, a smart parent can actually turn a disgusting piece of television into a life lesson. Engage your child in conversation about a questionable activity. Sex in sitcoms, misleading advertising, vulgar language can all be made into interesting discussions. Note the word discussion and go easy on the lectures. Your kids need to learn how TV entertainment and advertising work so they will not be prone to accepting mindless propaganda. Of course, irresponsible and lazy parents will not provide a buffer between the media madness and their kids. Those children will suffer. That is life in a free society. At another point in our conversation, Steve Allen made a related point. The question is, what kind of husbands and wives will our kids make? If they are buying into coarse television at an early age, what kind of adults will they become? Can we bring back Howdy Doody? Sure, about the time Calvin Coolidge becomes a household name again. And as I said, I would have rather mowed the lawn than watched Howdy. Even so, something about that darn puppet made me think he was a real person. Buffalo Bob told me that everybody thought Howdy was real. A slight exaggeration, but one with heart. How did Bob make that happen? Maybe it was because he wanted to help kids rather than exploit them for cash, and the kids could sense that. Buffalo Bob was a no-spin kind of guy. I did the last interview with him before he died at his home in Hendersonville, North Carolina, on July 30, 1998. He was 80 years old and sharp as a blade. I told Buffalo Bob, my father used to come home from work looking like a rumpled version of Robert Young and Father Knows Best. You know, a suit, white shirt, and a thin tie. So I'd go, hey, Dad, why don't you dress like Buffalo Bob? and he'd give me that look. I used that look, too, Buffalo Bob said, and it worked wonders, believe me. Yeah, but you didn't need a look, I replied. No kid wanted to be yelled at by Buffalo Bob. Even I didn't want that. Do you see any difference between the children of the 1950s and today? I really don't think there's an awful lot of difference, and I'll tell you why, he said. I think kids are kids. All kids like slapstick. All kids like fantasy. Kids laugh at the same things today that Clarabelle and I did 50 years ago. So, even though children have computers and 90 channels of television, they're still laughing at the same dopey stuff? There's no doubt about it, Buffalo Bob said. Kids know right away whether or not they like you. One time I got sick, and this guy from NBC was called in to replace me. He bombed. After the show, he said to me, when I walked in and saw those 40 little monsters there in the peanut gallery defying me to make them laugh, I knew I was dead. They knew right away that I couldn't stand them. So, that was the secret to your success, I said. You actually liked the kids. It was as simple as that, Buffalo Bob replied. He was right. Little kids laugh at the same stuff they always laughed at, and they instinctively know who the bad guys are. But in today's media swamp society, that instinct goes south with age, and today children grow up way too fast. By age 8 or 9, they are used to seeing and hearing things that would have been out of place in an army barracks 30 years ago. Do you even know about these things? Do you ever listen to the lyrics blasting upstairs in your kid's room or on the car radio? Or are you just grateful when they use earphones and seem to be bopping happily in the back seat? If you don't already know about the messages Puff Daddy and Eminem shout out from their pedestals atop the rap world, well, listen up. Chapter 4, Issue 4, Sex and Violence in Your Kid's Headphones. The opponent, rap star Sean Puff Daddy, P. Diddy, whatever, Combs. Even if you wouldn't be caught dead listening to rap music, it is hard to avoid this guy, Puff Daddy. He is in the newspaper nearly every week, dating Jennifer Lopez, being charged with crimes, being sued by the mother of his son. The Puffmeister is one big man about town. At age 32, Sean Combs is a multimillionaire rap singer and producer who parties with people like Donald Trump and Martha Stewart. He swaggers around Manhattan with a posse of hangers-on, drinking champagne in nightclubs and holding court in expensive restaurants. Of course, by exposing himself to the late-night rap world, Combs has brought a heap of trouble on himself. Here's a partial resume. In 1996, Combs was convicted of criminal mischief for threatening a photographer in New York City. In 1999, he was charged with ordering the beating of record executive Steve Stout. In that fracas, Stout's jaw and arm were broken. Combs pleaded guilty, and a judge sentenced him to 1 day in an anger management course. Perhaps Combs should have ordered the judge beaten after that kind of foolish sentence. Just a few months later, Combs was back in court, this time charged with gun possession and bribery in connection with the nightclub shootings of two bystanders. After a trial where one of the shooting victims flat-out identified Combs as pointing a pistol at her, he was acquitted. But then you probably knew that. I call the guy Puff the Magic Ragin and feel it's a shame that his decadent lifestyle is being played out in front of millions of his young fans. And I believe it is safe to say that a good portion of those fans do not have an emotional support system in place which can put Combs' irresponsible actions into perspective. The babes, the bucks, the busts, and the acquittals look kind of glamorous behind deprived eyes. Self-indulgence is the message received. Discipline, the most important ingredient in achieving lasting success, is not a part of the Puff Daddy world. Now, there's nothing strange about kids going nuts over new music and young performers who drive parents up the wall. Frank Sinatra became an establishment legend, but the frenzy of his female fans in his early days made many parents nervous. I was just a little kid when Elvis Presley gyrated his hips into the national spotlight. Just the week before, it seemed the big kids in the neighborhood all looked like members of the Kingston Trio, complete with flat-top haircuts. Then suddenly, Vinny and Eddie and Jimmy had greasy pompadours and sneers on their upper lips. So don't tell me a pop star isn't a huge influence on kids. I mean, to this day, there are adult Americans who think of Elvis daily, who still idolize him, and a few in Vegas who have turned into him. When the Beatles arrived from England in the early 60s, pop culture turned into the dominant money-making entertainment vehicle in the country. Some parents became very concerned when their kids adopted Cockney accents, but my father had just two words: great gimmick. This time the neighborhood was awash in bowl haircuts. Few guys even began calling each other blokes. Many of my friends got together and formed bands. I'm proud to say that even early on I was a contrarian, and Beatlemania did not affect me. I was a Beach Boys kind of guy. But it was not until the late 60s and 70s that the influence of rock people really kicked in with a behavior-altering intensity. Everybody under the age of 30 and the age of Aquarius knew that people like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, and Jim Morrison were heavily into intoxicants. None of them lived beyond the dreaded age of 30, but all had tremendous influence. Drugs and rock went together like Ozzy and Harriet. Songs celebrating drug use dominated the charts. In my neighborhood, at least six of my friends became heavily addicted. When the Jefferson Airplane sang about feeding your head, it sounded seductive. Why not groove with their music and get wasted when it looked like so much fun? Well, it wasn't long before the fun ended in two funerals. Two of my guys lost their lives because of drug abuse. At least five others lost their innocence and were never the same even after rehab. The groove they found didn't pay off in gold records. It paid off in continuing guilt and inner pain. Fast forward to the present. Some kids out there are watching every move Puffy Combs makes, and this should be troubling to anyone who cares about the question Steve Allen posed. What kind of adults will these kids be? Sample what Puff Daddy feeds them on one of his Smash Mouth CDs. "I'm a good fella kinda lady. Stash 380s and Mercedes. Puffy, hold me down, baby. Only female in my crew, and I kick blank like a blank do with a trigger to F-U." In case you're wondering, that's what passes for creativity in the world of Sean Combs and is typical of the stuff he puts out. With those lyrics and further dollar signs on his mind, Sean Puff Daddy Combs visited the No Spin Zone to promote an album. To many in show business, this was scarcely believable. Puff Daddy and O'Reilly? But he showed up, all 5'7" of him, strutting into the studio. He was decked out in a white T-shirt, khaki short pants, and sneakers. Followed by an entourage of 10, he checked the lights, the set, and the crew. Obviously, the Puffmeister was used to being in control. Finally, he was ready to go, and he sat across from your humble correspondent with a look of bored detachment. He didn't stay bored for long. I got right to the point. People are under the impression that rap music and this rap world is a violent, gangster-ridden, corrupt enterprise, I said. "That's definitely a wrong impression," Combs answered. "We live in a world where you definitely have bad apples at times, but bad apples can't spoil the whole bunch. That's not a fair label to put on rap. There's problems, but there's problems in all parts of the world. Hip-hop and rap is part of the world." "There is a synergy between you and some giant companies," I said. "The establishment corporations have put out your product. Here you guys are renegades, talking about the street and the inner city, and the guys in the suits are making bundles of dough off you guys." "I have a joint venture situation," Puff Daddy said. "And also, I'm sitting there with them with a suit on, and I'm telling them what I want. They don't tell me what to do. It's a partnership." "You're making them a lot of money," I reminded him. "Excuse me," he said. "They don't look at me like I'm a renegade rapper or anything like that. They look at me as a businessman. I'm somebody that has intelligence, that went to college. They look at me as the same human being you are. I mean, you may be looking at me as a renegade rapper, but I'm looking at